In the summer of 2020, Golf Digest launched Local Knowledge, a new podcast in which we take time to dive deep into some of golf's compelling topics. To close out this year, we're looking back at some of our favorite episodes from our first two seasons. And not surprisingly, some of our juiciest subjects had to do with money. Who makes too much? Who doesn't make enough? How certain players cover the costs of trying to make it on tour, and even how one performance can reverberate through an entire golf economy. I'm Keely Levins, and on this episode of Local Knowledge, we're looking back at how we've explored the fascinating intersection of golf and money. We begin with the robust economy of the PGA Tour. As you probably know, these guys make a ton of money. Rory McIlroy made over $24 million from tournaments in 2019. That's $24 million for 1 year's work, and that doesn't even count what he made in endorsements. When asked why the money is so good, a lot of people point to the effect Tiger had on the tour in securing huge TV deals and landing bigger than ever endorsement deals. But there was someone who laid the groundwork for him and the rest of the guys around him to cash in. Arnold Palmer was the first big-time player to work with an agent. Here's Dan Rappaport talking with one of our senior editors, Michael Johnson.
In late 1958, Mark McCormick pitched the idea of a representation to a few golfers. The idea was he'd go out and find them sponsorship deals so that they could focus on their golf. And he signed up a few, but by 1960, there was one star that burned brighter than the rest. There was one guy he wanted desperately, Arnold Palmer.
Palmer had yet to get on board, and what actually ended up occurring was Palmer wanted someone to represent him and only him. And so late 1959, early 1960, somewhere in that time frame, they got together and McCormick said, yeah, I'll do that. And Palmer and him had the famous handshake deal. It's one of the great stories of sports representation that they didn't have a formal contract. It was on a handshake, man of his word, two men of their word. And from there, things, you know, got interesting.
Getting around the country in comfort and style, for me, that has to be a Cadillac.
Everywhere I go, people ask me, Arnie, is that old tractor you drove in the Pennzoil commercial still running? Still running? We use it here at Latrobe every day.
Fortunately, I made the putt, and now all we have to do is wait and see what happens.
By 1960, McCormick wanted to take advantage of what he saw as a massive opportunity, the intersection of sports and television, which was just on its way to becoming a fixture in American households. McCormick started the International Management Group, which you may know as IMG, in 1960, with a golfer, Arnold Palmer, as his main client. With McCormick and TV's help, Palmer soon became a household name and a fixture in ads for any number of different products.
I think he had the one thing that you absolutely have to have as a product endorser. He was relatable. The everyman really related to Palmer in a way that they didn't with Nicklaus. Nicklaus was an amazing golfer, but he wasn't really a warm personality, and he almost seemed too perfect. You know, Palmer, everyone kind of knew his story. He was the Pennsylvania kid, grew up, you know, on the tractor at the golf course in Latrobe and hitched his pants up and the gopher broke style.
And there was one other thing that made him particularly effective at his job.
He was a good looking dude. I mean, there was no denying that. He had charisma in spades. He had that perfect combination of masculinity, charisma, playing style that just made him appeal to such a wide swath of people. He could, you know, sell sand in the desert, as they say.
So Palmer laid the foundation for golfers to become rich, like really stinking rich. But something else happened in the late 1960s that forever shifted the landscape of the professional game. So until then, tour pros played under the umbrella of the PGA of America, which is the same entity that oversaw and currently oversees club pros. But in the late 1960s, the tour pros realized they had different interests from the club pros, and they also realized that they had leverage. So they split from the PGA of America and formed the Tournament Players Division, which later became known as the PGA Tour.
Endorsement deals are an important part of pro golfers' bank accounts, but how you play on the weekend matters too. The major increase in prize money comes from sponsors, as well as lucrative TV deals. That's where Tiger came in.
Golf Channel, of course, is a huge reason why there is golf on TV every single weekend. But just because it's on, that doesn't mean people will watch it. And that was kind of a problem in the mid-90s. Yeah, there were great players like Norman and Nick Faldo and Nick Price, but a true superstar, a guy to carry the torch from Palmer and Nicholas, that wasn't there. Until this guy showed up.
I guess, hello world, huh?
That's Tiger Woods speaking on the eve of the 1996 Greater Milwaukee Open.
Thank you for being here today. Yesterday, I confirmed that I had decided to become a professional golfer.
Having won six straight USGA titles, he won three straight US Juniors and then three straight US Amateurs, there was obviously a bidding war for Tiger's signature. And during that announcement, Woods made it clear who had won that bidding war. He was wearing a black and green striped polo with the Nike swoosh adorned on his left breast. It was the first day of what was then the most lucrative endorsement deal in golf history and a truly iconic player-brand relationship. Back to our Mike Johnson.
He ushered in the era of the mega deal. His original five-year contract with Nike was for 5 years, $40 million. Then he re-upped for another 5 years at $100 million. That was followed by an eight-year deal estimated north of $200 million. So he really opened the door for guys, you know, the Mickelsons of the world, the McElroys of the world, to sign these very lengthy, very lucrative deals.
Woods won his first major at the Masters in April 1997. And immediately he became the biggest star in the sport and one of the biggest stars in sports, period. Tiger was a young, good-looking, multiracial kid with a glowing smile, and he hit the ball further than anyone else. So he appealed to a whole demographic of people that probably never cared about golf before that. It wasn't just white men anymore. There were more eyes and younger eyes on golf, so the PGA Tour could charge TV networks more money for the rights to broadcast their product. 1 month after Tiger's win at the Masters, the Tour announced a four-year, $400 million TV deal that was more than double the previous TV deal. That had an immediate impact on purses, because TV money tends to account for roughly 60% of the prize money for any given tournament. The rest is put up by the tournament sponsors, so not just the title sponsor, but the presented by sponsors. It's basically any company that has a presence at the tournament. And because of Tiger, more of these companies wanted to be associated with golf, so they'd offer up more money to sponsor the tournaments. Now, more TV money and more sponsorship money, that means more money for the players. The purses began to explode quickly. In 1995, the year before Woods turned pro, Greg Norman led the money list at $1.65 million. In 1997, Woods' first full year as a professional golfer, he led the money list at $2.06 million. 3 years later, in 2000, Woods won nine times and made $9.18 million. And the 23rd place finisher on the money list that year, Mark Calcavecchia, made more money than Greg Norman did in 1995. So the 23rd best golfer in 2000 was making more money than the best golfer in 1995. That's the difference Tiger made in just 5 years. So if golfers owe 25 cents of every dollar to Palmer, like Mike suggested, well, some of that dollar should probably also go to one Tiger Woods.
The Tour is now a world where players can have a season like Joel Damon, who had five top five finishes in 2020 and made over $2 million.
Wife and I just bought a second house in Scottsdale that we're going to remodel. We're going to use our first home for a rental house, you know, for an investment property. And it was only a couple years ago and we couldn't afford very much. So, the money out here is comical. We're the best, whatever, 200 players in the world at what we do. So I don't know if anybody deserves this much money, but, you know, I'm certainly not going to complain about it.
Okay, so the top guys on the PGA Tour have it made. I think we can all agree on that. But what about the players on the LPGA Tour? Purses have increased on the tour to put top players in a position to make good money. But the drop-off is more severe. Let's just say Joel Damon, who finished 35th in regular season money in 2020, he's living a whole lot comfier than the player who's 35th on the LPGA Tour's money list. I spoke with LPGA Tour players Lindsay Weaver, Angel Yin, and Meg Mallon, among others in the industry, to explore the financial realities of surviving on the women's tour.
The LPGA Tour doesn't have the same purses as the PGA Tour, but as Lindsay Weaver learned, it does have all the travel expenses, maybe even more.
Coming out into the LPGA, it was kind of a, I guess I wasn't really surprised, but it's definitely a big factor, and it's a pretty big stress. Just, you know, rental cars and flights and hotels, and it's just, it really adds up week to week. And so if it's kind of like, if you're not making money, it's like you're shelling out a couple thousand at least, you know, with a caddy and everything, it's at least like a few thousand dollars, like $3,000, $4,000, $5,000 sometimes just to play that week.
Weaver has cut costs in a surprising way this season. She's been using a push cart. She used it at the AIG Women's British Open this year, where she finished T19. Usually, Weaver uses a local caddy, but in an effort to limit the number of people that are coming in and out of the tournament bubble, the tour isn't allowing local caddies this year.
Because of that, they're allowing push carts, which is a significant money saver.
So the rate for a local caddy is $100 a day plus tip, so somewhere around $700. But for a professional caddy that you hire out here, it's like $1,200 to $1,400 plus percentage if you make the cut. Which if you make the cut, it's typically 10-7-5. So 10 if you win, 7% if you're top 10, and then 5% outside of that.
Which is great. Except, let's remember that caddies are expensive for a reason. They help. Weaver might be losing a few shots around by using a push cart instead of having someone to strategize with on course.
It is kind of weird, like, being out there by yourself when everybody else has like, you know, a team with them. You think you're doing pretty well, and then you add up everything up at the end of the year, and it's like, oh my God, I spent this much money, because it just goes so fast.
Right, and it's all necessities, like.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
And that's not even counting other members on an LPGA Tour's team who require compensation.
I have a physio, which a professional term is called osteopath, that follows me to treat me and keep my body 100% so I can play at my best. We have, our tour provides us physios too, but at the same time, it's harder because of the pandemic, they can only treat you for like 15 minutes. Sometimes your body needs something longer, like you need more work stuff done, then you just have to hire your own.
And then of course, you have to eat and pay your rent or your mortgage and your phone bill and your Netflix subscription. The list goes on. And what makes all of this harder is that most LPGA players are doing this without the support of sponsors. Again, this is not as much of an issue on the PGA Tour, where most players have a series of logos on their shirts and hat that reflect sponsors who are paying them. On the LPGA, meanwhile, the money used to pay for all of this comes predominantly from money won at tournaments. In the off season, you're living on whatever you made during the season.
My dad always tells me, like, money follows, it doesn't lead. So it's like, as long as you just, like, keep playing well, like, money will follow. And it'll take care of itself, but it's not something that you like really think about. But even like for me, it's like I played pretty well at the beginning of like the restart and everything, but then it's like I missed the cut at ANA, and then I had to withdraw in Portland for medical reasons. And so then it's like, oh, I feel like I haven't made any money in a long time. So I'm like, oh, I need to, you know, make money. It's never like you feel secure.
It's not like that on the PGA Tour, obviously. You can see the deals guys get just by looking at their bags, shirts, and Instagram posts. It's not even like that on the Korn Ferry Tour.
So it's just a very interesting dynamic, and it's like the only job that you can really, that it's like this, where you spend thousands of dollars every week just to have the opportunity to make money. So it's like every week you're already like this much money in the hole.
Even a player of Yin status feels like the only real way to make money is by winning it at a tournament. You can't rely on a sponsor to take the financial stress off of your tour life. Despite playing on 2 Solheim Cups and being ranked as high as top 30 in the world, she's only found a few sponsors.
I have my bag, KBS. He's actually more like a friend than a sponsor. He's a good friend of my coach. And then he just was like, hey, you know, I want to help you out. I was like, oh, great. I love it. I love help. So that's how I went. Great guy. This is our second year together. Titleist for Ball and Glove. And then my clothing sponsor, JDX, we've worked together since I played on an LPGA. So it's been quite some time. And then, yeah, that's about it. Not a lot for someone who played on 2 Solheims.
This isn't new for LPGA Tour players. Meg Mallon, 18-time LPGA Tour winner, 4-time major champ, and World Golf Hall of Fame member, is a prime example of how results on the LPGA Tour don't automatically equate to sponsorship deals.
In 2004, I was probably top 2 or 3 Americans at the time. I had no sponsorship. I was the leading Solheim Cup American of all time on points at that point. I had no sponsorships. I played the U.S. Open in 2004 wearing a USGA U.S. Open cap, and I won the tournament. So that to me was, even though I had had a great career, played well, top American, didn't have a sponsor. I got one after that. Fidelity Investments came to me after that, which was fantastic. So some companies come through, but it's even, you know, it's always been the story of women's golf, not necessarily your performance all the time that does get you sponsors. And I was kind of proof of that.
Mallon had already won 3 majors by that point. You can be a proven success on tour and still not be guaranteed sponsorship. If winning majors isn't going to get you sponsors, what will?
I'm not going to lie. It hurt. Like it hurt because, you know, it's like, you know, do I need to lose weight? Do I need to be prettier? All the things that women do to themselves, right? Is that what it is? And honestly, that didn't, I mean, I knew that was part of it. Certainly a big part of being a female athlete, but it didn't affect how I was going to play. I was never going to let it affect my psyche, but you know, they just weren't coming my way. It was an older player, been around a long time, you know, and it just, the appeal wasn't there.
Other players of Mallon's era were facing the same issues.
And I remember Laura Davies in the mid-90s was one of the top players in the world, and Nike came to offer her $5,000 for the year. And it was so insulting, you know, it was just so insulting, like, you know, thinking that they were doing her a favor. And that's how you always felt.
Though it's still financially strenuous for many players on the LPGA Tour, things are heading in a good direction. Mike Wan, who was commissioner of the LPGA for 11 years, has seen a recent shift in the mentality around corporate sponsorship. The direct effect is growing purses on tour.
Companies have always looked internally when they talk about corporate values, what we mean, what's important to us, you know, women, minority, leadership. They've always talked about that as an inside the building thing. In the last 5 or 6 years, companies are finally starting to hold that same mirror up to their dollars spent and realizing, how can we have this conversation about equality and at the same time spend 97% of our dollars on male sports?
Think about where you work. The conversations about diversity and inclusion are happening constantly. It makes sense that the same conversations, the same values, will eventually be applied to women's sports.
There is no doubt that we are in the middle of a new awakening. How fast that awakening goes, how global that awakening goes, and what's the threshold? I don't know, but I can tell you it's never been more enjoyable to sell my sport in the corporate world.
Guys who come up through the mini tours also know something about how tough it can be to make life as a professional golfer work. Dan Rappaport talked to Willie Wilcox, Joel Damon, and their financial backers about how funding works with an individual donor, or, as the podcast title likes to call them, sugar daddies. Sometimes players hit the jackpot and meet someone who'll just give them their credit card. Joel Damon had that situation. But more often than not, the deal's more nuanced, with the benefactor wanting to get something for his investment and wanting to be along for the ride to the tour.
Clayton State is a small Division II school about an hour outside of Atlanta. Hardly a golf powerhouse, but Will ends up winning the 2008 Alabama Amateur Championship and becomes a three-time All-American there. He decides he wants to turn pro. But being a three-time All-American at Clayton State is not the same as being a three-time All-American at Oklahoma State. And that, plus Will's criminal history, made him a tough sell to corporate sponsors. So he decided he'd ask his friend's rich dad, who he knew liked to gamble.
Well, basically, they came to me and asked me would I be interested in getting a group together to sponsor him on the tour, and I told him no, I just wanted to do it myself. And basically, my son had always told me what a great player he, you know, and I've watched him play before, and I thought there was talent there, and I thought it'd be, you know, decent investment.
So that, as opposed to Bobby Seitz's benevolence, is how it usually goes. A rich guy knows an up-and-coming pro, and he wants to help him. But he also wants a chance to make money. So while Damon had Bob's credit card, Will's situation was much more structured. He goes to Tim's used car lot, remember, the old Dairy Queen, and they hammer out terms on an 8-year deal.
First 4 years, 100% expense paid. The first 50 grand, he took 70%. And then post 50 grand earned on the golf course, I got 60%, he got 40. And then the last 4 years, you know, he was basically banking on me making it to the tour and no expenses paid. And he earned 9% at the end of the year of the total earnings.
This story has a happy ending. Will did indeed get to the PGA Tour, and it happened pretty much on the exact timeline that they were planning. But in those early days, before Will got status anywhere, he was playing mini-tour event after mini-tour event after mini-tour event, and Tim was in the hole.
At one point, when I was about a year into it, or no, maybe I was only 6 months into it, he was like, I just remember him being like, damn, Willie, I'm down 14 grand. And I just, that hit me hard, and I think he knew that it did, and that wasn't productive.
It wasn't good telling you how much money you were costing him.
Yeah, exactly. And I was just, you know, I mean, 14 grand to me at that time was like $1 million. I mean, it was like, I was just, anyhow, after that, I ended up hitting it pretty big. I won a couple events for 40,000 my first year out. And then we just started rolling.
4 years after turning pro, Wilcox got his PGA Tour card for the 2013-14 season. And remember, after year four of the deal with Tim didn't have to put up a single dollar and would receive 9% of Wilcox's on-course earnings. So just as he was off the hook, Wilcox started playing for big boy money.
And this is Will Wilcox setting up a little left. Clubface aiming a little right. An interesting squirm at that one. There you go. There you go.
That was our man Willie Wilcox acing the Island Green 17th hole at TPC Sawgrass during the 2016 Players Championship. And that'll probably be the enduring memory of Will's golf career, but it actually came at the tail end of his time on the PGA Tour. Will made 56 starts on the PGA Tour from 2013 through the end of the 2015-16 season. And when you include his earnings from the rare Korn Ferry start during those years, he made $2,494,000 $942 from January 2014 through July 2016. 9% of that, and thus a rough estimate of Jackson's cut, equals $224,544. And that wasn't Jackson's only profit on Will.
Vegas would always put, you know, on the main tour, Vegas would put out odds on finishing top 10, top 20, you know, all kind of little bets like that. We'd just play, you know, bet $100 here or there or something.
A wager on top of a wager. During Will's time on the tour, these two dudes from Pell City, Alabama absolutely took a moment to smell the roses, to enjoy their time in the sun.
When I was on tour, I mean, we'd just be laughing hysterically about the money we were making. You know, he flew to a lot of my tournaments. We ate dinner every night. We talked on the phone multiple times a week. I mean, especially when I'm playing good.
Yeah.
You know, we'd just have a great time drinking nice bottles of wine and just laughing about how good life was.
And that's another huge motivation for someone like Tim or Bob. You have a horse in the race. You feel like you're involved on the professional golf journey. You get the rush of competition without ever having to hit a shot. And you have a pretty cool story to tell your golfing buddies.
We'd get in the clubhouse and see all the players and get to eat with them and got to hang out like that. To me, it was worth, I can't tell you what that was like. I mean, you'd be in the clubhouse and all the big pros or stars were in there and getting to see them and speak to them. And, you know, it was just a great experience.
While the deal Wilcox and Jackson had was a great one, there are plenty of deals that don't go as well. These are often handshake deals, and without specific terms written out in a formal contract, things can get dicey.
Another cautionary tale is that of Champagne Tony Lima, one of the stars of the PGA Tour in the 1960s and the winner of the 1964 Open Championship. Before that success, though, Lima was just a local pro wanting to play the tour without the money to do so. So he struck up a deal with a businessman named Jim Malarkey, who had made a bunch of money in the plywood business. Here's Guy Yoakum, a former Golf Digest senior writer and basically a golf encyclopedia.
The terms of the deal was Malarkey would give him this money. He would front him a certain amount of money, so usually a neighborhood of $15,000 or $16,000. And Lima would have to pay that back. This was not a gift. And the debt from year to year would carry forward and it would accumulate. And then whatever Lima won in prize winnings, he had to give Malarkey a third of that. And not only of his prize winnings, but anything that he made off the golf course. So it was a tough deal.
Tough indeed. It sounds like something Mr. Wonderful on Shark Tank would propose. This was a loan. If Lima didn't make $16,000 that year, which was not that easy to do in those days, he'd have to pay Lima back, one way or the other. Lima was in debt throughout the early 60s, and it ate at him personally and professionally. In 1963, he hired a team of lawyers to get out of the deal. He skipped the Open Championship, the Western Open, and the Canadian Open that year, and these were all big events, to work with his attorneys, who eventually did get him out. Here's what Lima said of the ordeal. I was not only flat broke after having earned $110,000 in 18 months, but I was in hock up to my ears. That's equivalent to $942,000 today, by the way. Here's Lima again. I'm embarrassed to say what I had to pay Malarkey to get out of the contract, but anyone can figure out that it came out to a good deal more than $50,000. Another sponsorship rift involves Tony Finau, who was recently sued for more than $16 million by Molinai Hola, a different investor than the one who fronted the $50,000 for the Ultimate Game when Finau was 17. In the suit, Hola says he paid excuse for Finau and his family for several years with the expectation he'd be reimbursed for those expenses and receive 20% of Finau and his brother Gipper's professional earnings. Lawyers for Finau, however, dispute the facts of the original deal and claim Hola's demands for repayment fall outside the statute of limitations. The matter remains unresolved. The sugar daddy business is a risky business, even in the famously risk-averse world of golf. Of course, Joel Damon and Will Wilcox and Jared Hack and probably Tony Lima and Tony Finau would have preferred to have their sponsorship money come from TaylorMade or Morgan Stanley. But someone in the situation of, say, 23-year-old Joel Damon, they'll take any dollar they can get.
A lot of people say, oh, if you're good enough, you'd always make it. I don't know without Bob who would I've ever even maybe even tried.
When a guy like Wilcox plays well, it changes things for him and his sponsor, or sugar daddy, as Dan would say. But some players have the power to change an entire country's golf economy when they win. When Hideki Matsuyama won the Masters, the predictions for what that win could mean for golf in Japan went to extremes. 3 months after the win, Alex Myers looked at Japan, a golf-crazed country that finally got a male major champion.
If you watched Matsuyama's win from the U.S.,
You might have sensed his win resonated in a big way back home, but you probably don't realize how big a deal it really was. It's hard to comprehend because, well, it's just different.
We don't really have national heroes like that in the U.S.
That's Golf Digest senior editor Mike Stachura, who covers equipment and golf business, and who wrote a story about the ripple effect Matsuyama's momentous victory could have in his homeland.
You know, the only thing I can think of that would be similar is when the U.S. won the gold medal in hockey at the Olympics in 1980 against the Soviet team.
Sure.
And all those guys, you know, whether they were, you know, stars on the team or just, you know, worker bees, became instant celebrities.
Right.
Well, Hideki already was a massive celebrity.
And as we arrive at the Green Jacket winner's attempt to win a gold medal in his home country, Stachura and others in the golf industry think the makings of another golf boom in Japan and beyond is possible. No offense to Mickelson, Morikawa, or Rahm, but their major wins won't register at the same level as Matsuyama's.
You've heard it countless times since Hideki's win. It's great for the game. And maybe that's lost on people that are fringe golf fans. What does it mean it's good for the game? Well, our game isn't about what takes place just in the United States. Our game, unlike a lot of sports that we follow here, it truly has a worldwide reach.
Andy Yamanaka, Secretary General of the Japan Golf Association, also described an emotional scene after the country produced its first Masters champion.
You know, how many Japanese fans or audiences cried in front of the TV, including, you know, Tomi Nakajima, one of the Japanese legends, who was a TV commentator for Japanese TV, and he couldn't say anything because he was just crying. And it was definitely the biggest news, the greatest news for golf in Japan ever.
The minute Matsuyama won, the country's national alert system sent out a notice of congratulations. Of course, most of the country was already well aware. More than half of the country's TVs were tuned in to Matsuyama's win, a number that was hurt at least a little by the fact that many were already supposed to be beginning their work week.
The fact is, in Japan, that, you know, the Masters was probably on at 4 or 5 o'clock in the morning on a Monday, and the Japanese people don't take off work. So literally they would take the train early into work and all gather around TVs at work to be enthralled by this. You know, so it's, again, it's unlike anything in our country.
It's only been 3 months, but insiders have already seen a Matsuyama effect. Yamanaka says the overall number of golfers is up a whopping 10% since last year. It's a leap that certainly has to do with COVID and other Japanese golfers playing well, like the LPGA's Nasa Hatayoka and Augusta National women's amateur champ Tsubasa Kajitani. But Gorwin says Hideki deserves most of the credit, and Matsuyama-related merchandise and memorabilia are in high demand.
An example, there's a retailer here called Golf Partner, and Golf Partner have retail outlets. You know, there's hundreds of them all over the country. And the following day, on the Monday, they had a special where, I think I'm right in saying this, it was anything that was Strix and, you know, clubs, they had special offers. You know, it was a certain discount on all those types of goods, whether it's clubs and towels and balls and things like that. And they were sold out.
Mm.
I mean, the Japanese golfing public went nuts.
As someone who grew up in Australia during the 1980s, Gorwin can appreciate how much one person can influence an entire sport. He credits Greg Norman for inspiring people like him to pursue a career in golf, not to mention a wave of great tour pros, including Adam Scott, who became the first Aussie to win the Masters in 2013. Gorwin says he's already seeing the beginning of a similar movement taking place in Japan.
I work for Taiyo Club just regular hours, and then in the evening I still do a few lessons for people. And after the after Hideki won, the driving ranges were full. I mean, full of, and what was interesting, it was young university students, and you'd see groups of them getting down there and hitting a few balls. Mm. Our tee sheets are full. You know, people are out playing. Of course, COVID, you know, everybody's stuck here. So, but the, you know, golf is considered a safe place to play, you know, to spend some time. But there's definitely been an uptick in people hitting golf balls at driving ranges, people playing golf, buying equipment. I go into retail stores and things like that. And there's places are full. I mean, golf is huge here.
But just how huge can it get? Statura reports the number of overall golfers had been cut nearly 50% from the peak of more than 12 million a quarter century ago. Could Matsuyama's win help bring that number back? It could, but we might need nearly that long to find out.
I think what's interesting to me is what happens 10, 15 years down the road, because there's no question that there are a lot of parents with younger kids who saw Hideki's win, and just like with Tiger's win in 1997, their kid is going to be the next Hideki, and we're going to find, you know, is there going to be a rush of those types of stories 15, 20 years from now? And we have this kind of Japanese wave of great players that grew out of Hideki's win.
This special episode of Local Knowledge is the second in a series where we revisit our favorite episodes from our first two seasons. Local Knowledge is produced by Greg Gottfried with editorial guidance from Sam Weinman. Our music is Spirit of Freedom by Lobo Loco. You can subscribe to Local Knowledge wherever you get your podcasts, and we welcome a review as well. Also, for expert picks, betting advice, and insights into the action on the PGA Tour, please also make sure to subscribe to our Be Right podcast.